The heritage America stands on today is reflected vividly in the lives of great American authors. With the belief that all Americans should come to know better the lives and works of great American writers, WSUI presents another in the series of programs about famous American authors. This series is designed to acquaint you with authors from all periods of American history. It brings to life the stories of those American men and women who created the great literary history of which we are all so justly proud.
Have you heard of the wonderful one-horse shay that was built in such a logical way? It ran 100 years to a day, and then of a sudden it... Ah, but stay, I'll tell you what happened without delay. Oliver Wendell Holmes, his life and the long curve of his career, embraced and expressed the golden age of Boston. When he was born in 1809, the town differed little from the colonial capital which outraged patriots had besieged by camping on Boston Neck. When he died, Boston Neck had disappeared in the vast real estate development which followed the filling in of Back Bay in the 50s. The little town which had once been governed by a town meeting had now become a cosmopolitan city. There was, however, still an atmosphere rich with the past, with the traditions which made old Boston what it was.
Come on, Tommy. Uncle Oliver's home from Harvard, and he's going to show us Garrett his house. Hurry up.
Really? Look, Garrett. Oh, boy. I'll bet there's ghosts and things up here.
Hello there, boys. Ghosts? You know, the worst part of a modern-style mansion is there's no place for ghosts. But come on in. This is a fine afternoon for poking about.
Oh, boy. Gee. I bet some of these things have been up here for 100 years.
You're quite right, boys. And see here on the window. Men who were here at Harvard long ago wrote their names on the glass with diamonds for us to see.
Gee, John Tracy, 1738. Why, that's almost 100 years ago, isn't it?
Yes, and that's not all. It was right here in this house that the Battle of Bunker Hill was planned.
Golly, Uncle Oliver, that was during the Revolution.
Yes, lad. And out there on the green, the American soldiers stopped for prayers from the college president before they marched off to battle.
Say, I'll bet you do have ghosts up here. Real honest-to-goodness American ones that helped start our country out.
Indeed, Tommy. Look out there in the common. It was under that very tree that George Washington came to take command of the Continental Army.
Now, in building of shays, I'll tell you what. There's always somewhere a weakest spot. In hub, tire, fellow, in spring or thill, in panel, a crossbar, a floor, a sill, in screw, bolt, thoroughbrace, lurking still, find it somewhere you must and will, above or below or within or without. And that's the reason, beyond a doubt, that a shay breaks down, but it doesn't wear out. Yes, the very air in Boston and Cambridge was steeped with tradition. 200 years of it. And Oliver Wendell Holmes was the product and the representative of old New England. Mr. Holmes had been studying law there at Harvard, but he seemed to feel that the legal profession was not for him, and so he turned to medicine. And after several years, became a professor in the Harvard Medical School in 1847.
Well, Dr. Holmes, I feel that it's entirely out of place and highly improper for women to enter the medical profession. Women were not intended to do a man's work.
Yes, Mr. Currier, go on. And as a nurse?
Nursing, sir, would be the only acceptable profession for women.
Well, I've always felt that this was rather the vocation of women than general medical, and especially surgical practice. Yes, yet, I myself followed the course of lectures given by the young Madame La Chapelle in Paris. And if here and there an intrepid woman insists on taking by storm the fortress of medical education, I would have the gate flung open to her, as if it were that of the citadel of Orleans, and she, Joan of Arc, returning from the field of victory.
Thoroughbrace bison skin, thick and wide. Boot, top, Dasher from tough old hide found in the pit when the tanner died. That was the way he put her through. "There," said the deacon, "now she'll do." Holmes' natural conservatism did not prevent him from giving his approval to reform movements. When, in 1853, Longfellow, Lowell, and Mrs. Stowe proposed to establish a literary and anti-slavery magazine, Dr. Holmes pledged his full support.
"Gentlemen, we have met to make the last arrangements on this new magazine. Mr. Lowell will be the editor. Mr. Emerson, will you still be able to contribute?"
Yes, certainly.
"Mr. Cabot and Mr. Holmes?"
Yes, of course.
"Splendid. As you know, we have been 4 long years trying to start our little venture. It seems that at last we may succeed. But there is one more thing. The literary and anti-slavery magazine does seem an awkward title for our fine journal. Surely we can invent a better."
"I would suggest we call it the Pioneer."
No. That hasn't the proper ring. This will be a monthly publication. Why not call it the Atlantic Monthly?"
"Why,
splendid.
That's it, the Atlantic Monthly."
"Little of all we value here wakes on the morn of its 100th year without both feeling and looking queer. In fact, there's nothing that keeps its youth, as far as I know, but a tree and truth." And so the Atlantic Monthly was born. And in the first issues began to appear the articles by Holmes that would become the book we know as The Autocrat of the Breakfast Table.
"You don't suppose that my remarks made at this table are like so many postage stamps, do you? Each to be only once uttered. If you do, you're mistaken. He must be a poor creature that does not often repeat himself. Why, the truths the man carries about with him are his tools. And do you think a carpenter is bound to use the same plane but once to smooth a knotty board with, or to hang his hammer up after it's driven its first nail? Do you agree, Phillips?"
"You're right, Dr. Holmes. It's a pity more men aren't like you, instead of saving their bright thoughts as though they were too precious for conversation."
"Yes, Dr. Holmes. Don't you realize that you are wasting saleable literature, a cash article, at about the rate of $50 an hour when you talk to us?"
"My dear, I want you to look out the window there and tell me what you see."
"Nothing but a very dusty street and a man driving a sprinkling machine over it."
"Why don't you tell the man he's wasting that water? Oh, what would be the state of the highways of life if we did not drive our thought sprinklers through them with the valves open sometimes? Besides that, there's another thing about this talking that you forgot. It shapes our thoughts for us. The waves of conversation roll them as the surf rolls the pebbles on the shore. Let me modify the image a little. I rough out my thoughts in talk as an artist models in clay. Spoken language is so plastic, you can pat and coax and spread and shave and rub out and fill up and stick on so easily when you work with that soft material that there's nothing like it for modeling. Out of it come the shapes which you turn into marble or bronze in your immortal books."
"Do. I tell you, I rather guess she was a wonder, and nothing less. Coats grew horses, beards turned gray, deacon and deaconess dropped away, children and grandchildren. Where are they? But there stood the stout old one-horse shay, as fresh as on Lisbon earthquake day." Dr. Holmes was indeed a man of brilliant conversational gifts. He was one of the most notable of the noted circle which composed the Saturday Club in Boston. Longfellow, Emerson, Lowell, Whittier, Thoreau, Bayard Taylor, and the others. These gentlemen were wont to meet in the back parlor of that historical publisher, James T. Fields. With all these and many others, Holmes lived on terms of affectionate regard and comradeship.
"Talk about conceit as much as you like. It is to human character what salt is to the ocean. It keeps it sweet and renders it endurable."
"So you admire conceited people, do you?"
"I'm afraid you do not study logic at your school, my dear. It does not follow that I wish to be pickled in brine because I like a saltwater plunge.
I say that conceit is just as natural a thing to human minds as a center is to a circle. The difficulty is that little-minded people's thoughts move in such small circles that 5 minutes' conversation gives you an arc long enough to determine their whole curve. Talking is like playing on the harp. There is as much in laying the hand on the strings to stop their vibrations as in twanging them to bring out their music.
Yes, Dr. Holmes was very fond of conversation. Sitting about and philosophizing with his friends and with his fellow boarders, whom he describes in The Autocrat of the Breakfast Table. But he also had a mind in which unexpected baubles of fun were likely to come to the surface at any moment. He had a temperament which not only took delight in the fun, but in all the cheerful side of human existence.
Good morning, Dr. Holmes.
Good morning, my dear. And how is your schoolwork coming?
Oh, very nicely, thank you. My mother's been inquiring after your health. She sends her greetings to you.
Oh, very kind of her.
Mother told me the other day that she remembers you well when you were a baby. You were brought up on a bottle, you know.
I was. How oddly our antenatal history comes out. I'm rather glad to know, however. Henceforth, I shall feel as tenderly every time I visit my wine cellar as Romulus and Remus did when Faustula carried them to the menagerie and showed them to the wolf in his cage.
Oh, why, Dr. Holmes.
First of November, the earthquake came. Traces of age in the one-horse shade, a general flavor of mild decay, but nothing local, as one may say.
Well, I didn't know Holmes was coming in, but I'm sure.
Oh, Dr. Holmes! Dr. Holmes! Oh, here you are, sir. Dr. Holmes, I want to welcome you to England. My country is most honored by this visit from you. James here will take your bags. How was the crossing?
I say in conclusion that I have nowhere been accorded the courtesy and kindnesses that you in England have shown me. I wish to take this opportunity to state that my 77 years of life almost prohibited my taking this trip. But now that I have come, I'm ashamed that any such small consideration should have hindered my visit to your grand island.
Yes, few men have had in their later years such an intoxicating ovation as was awarded to Oliver Wendell Holmes in England at the age of 77. But he wrote 5 years later to Whittier,
"We are lonely, very lonely in these last years. We were on the deck together as we began the voyage of life 2 generations ago. A whole generation passed. And the succeeding one found us in the cabin with a goodly number of coevals. Then the craft which held us began going to pieces, until a few of us were left on the raft pieced together of its fragments. And now the raft has at last parted, and you and I are left clinging to this solitary spar."
At 9:30 by the meeting house clock, just the hour of the earthquake shock, what do you think the parson found when he got up and stared around? The poor old shay in a heap or mound, as if it had been to the mill and ground. You see, of course, if you're not a dunce, how it went to pieces all at once, and nothing first, just as bubbles do when they burst. End of the wonderful one-horse show. Logic is logic. That's what I say.
You have just heard another in the series of programs, Famous American Authors. These programs are presented with the belief that all people should come to know and better understand the great literary heritage of which we are all so justly proud. Today's story of Oliver Wendell Holmes was written for radio by Abigail Nielsen. Listen next week for another program in the series, Great American Authors.